2002 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session number 111, The Work of Death, Humidity and War, a paper presented by Boyd Peterson.
Okay, we're ready to begin. Welcome to the first session of Sunstone for this year. This session is entitled The Work of Death, Hugh Nibley on War. Before we commence with Boyd's presentation, we do have a few announcements. All of the sessions that are scheduled to take place in Executive A room have been moved to Wasatch Room. So if there was any of those in your schedule that you were wanting to see, make a note of that, or you'll be sitting by yourself. Please be aware, as most of you probably are, that this symposium begins with a presentation on Hugh Nibley and will also end with a presentation on Hugh Nibley. Saturday night, the dinner banquet at 7 o'clock will feature a roast of Hugh Nibley and then cutting them apart. And so you'll all want to partake in that, because that promises to be also a very, very good presentation and very funny presentation. I've known Boyd going on 17 years, and in that entire 17 years, he's always been fascinated with Hugh Nibley. It might be partially a result of his marrying one of Nibley's daughters, Zina, but I think he would probably have been fascinated anyway. Boyd is just finished a biography on Brother Nibley entitled Hugh Nibley, A Consecrated Life, forthcoming this December from what press? Coford Books. And so just in time for Christmas. He has 3.5 kids, teaches at BYU, and is still seeking to accomplish his PhD program in comparative literature. So without any further ado, since we're starting late, I'll turn the time over to Boyd. Please keep in mind any questions that you might have, because you will be the respondents to Boyd's paper this morning, and we encourage your participation. Thank you.
I hope the technology is worth it here. I think it is. I've got some great slides. So, during Operation Market Garden, the 72-day bloody and ill-fated invasion of Holland, Master Sergeant David Harmon was on a patrol with Colonel Howard R. Johnson when they saw a car being driven by a German officer. Johnson ordered Harmon to shoot the German, since he might be carrying information that would help the Allies. It was a moving target, but at medium range. Harmon lifted his rifle and fired, hitting the driver in the head and killing him instantly. Sure enough, in the car they found a briefcase crammed with secret documents. Although he had obeyed an order during wartime patrol, Harmon was deeply troubled by having killed the German officer in such a calculated way. He'd done a lot of shooting, Hugh Nibley remembers, but for some reason the fact that he had shot this officer in the head preyed on his mind. Following the withdrawal of U.S. forces to Mormolon-le-Grand on November 28th of 1944, Hugh was sharing a tent with Harmon. Harmon ended up giving Hugh the German officer's briefcase, locks broken, its fine leather stained with blood, but still functional. One night, Harmon came into the tent, sat down on the bunk next to Hugh, and asked, "Nibley, if I want to kill myself, it's my own goddamn business, isn't it?" As calmly as he could, Hugh tried to assure Harmon that killing himself would affect a lot of other people, and it was really not a good solution. But, quote, suddenly he whipped out a little Beretta automatic that he had in his pocket, a little Italian Beretta, shot himself right through the head, blood spattering all over the place. I put towels around his head and then ran over to the medics, but he was dead before that. He just couldn't stand living with it. For more than 30 years, Hugh carried that briefcase with him while teaching at BYU and invariably bulged with books and papers, but its real purpose was to serve as a lasting and tangible symbol of the evils of war. Hugh Nibley, I believe, knows warfare, both ancient and modern, better than most. As a result of that very expertise, he has an unshakable cynicism about war. At the time of World War II, Hugh's knowledge of ancient history made him skeptical about the effectiveness of war as a solution to the world's problems, but his involvement in World War II left him convinced that war in general is, quote, a nasty and immoral business. In the men who fought on both sides of the conflict, Hugh discovered both heroism and unspeakable cruelty. While affirming that, quote, the heroism and sacrifice were real, Hugh has unsparingly denounced the situation of war as utterly satanic and shameful. Hugh's understanding about war and warfare began as a young boy. When Hugh heard long discussions about World War I around the dinner table at his home in Portland, Oregon. In California, growing up as a teenager, he received proficiency awards for his involvement in the ROTC program in his high school, and his instructor had served in the Spanish-American War. Likewise, he was required to take ROTC throughout his undergraduate days at UCLA. And both at UCLA and in his PhD program at Berkeley, Hugh studied ancient warfare in his classical history courses. Let's see. Okay. In 1927, at the age of 17, Hugh was called to serve in the Swiss-German mission, just prior to World War II. Letters he wrote after a year of missionary work in Germany hauntingly describe the general psyche of the German people just prior to the war. Quote, "Nobody in Germany believes in a God. The strongest Catholics in Frankenthal are professed atheists, and the suddenness of the thing is unbelievable. One feels a strange spirit like a cloud, a real thing that makes people every week more testy and intolerant. You feel the spirit closing in on the people. Something mean and unpleasant seems to inhabit the average house. Not a spirit of uncertainty, but of settled, determined indifference." 10 years after this letter was written, Germany had repudiated the Versailles Treaty, which ended World War I, remilitarized, occupied the Rhineland, annexed Austria, partitioned Czechoslovakia, and again it began its campaign against the Jews. On September 1st of 1939, Britain declared war on Germany after Germany invaded Poland. For Hugh, the conflict in Europe was personal. While he had been at times quite critical of the German people on his mission, he nevertheless had a deep love for Germany, its language, culture, and people. As he put it, quote, "My adolescent thinking was all cast in the German mold." He also had retained many friends in the church branches where he had served. Undoubtedly, the events in Europe caused a great deal of internal conflict for Hugh. In the letter he wrote around 1939, Hugh stated that his position about what he called the international situation was the same as most isolationist Americans at the time. "I remain neutral," wrote Hugh, "but more against the Allies than the Germans." By 1942, Hugh had changed his mind. On 28 September 1942, Hugh had enlisted and was inducted into the Army at Fort MacArthur, located in just south of Los Angeles. After six months of training, basic training in Florida and then in Illinois, Hugh had earned an Army diploma as a weather observer and was working at the 99th Air Base Squadron in Godman Field near Fort Knox, Kentucky. It was then that the government finally realized the language expertise Hugh had to offer, and Hugh was transferred into Army intelligence and training at Camp Ritchie in rural Maryland. And Camp Ritchie's a marvelously interesting place, but I'm going to skip a lot of this information, so you have to buy the book to find out about this. Camp Ritchie was just a real hodgepodge of all kinds of people who spoke a myriad of different languages, really strange and exotic place at the time. And the Army was just starting military intelligence, so they didn't quite know what they were doing yet. However, at Camp Ritchie, Hugh underwent an 8-week course in interrogation techniques, IPW, and he had moral objections at the time to trying to extract secrets from men who were under orders not to reveal information. So Hugh, along with 17 officers and enlisted men, was enrolled in a super secret second order of battle course at Camp Ritchie. OB students studied units, weapons, positions of the German and Italian military, and received detailed lectures on German strategy. They also studied such theoretical texts as Karl von Clausewitz's theories on war. So they got a lot of extensive training on both the theoretical and the practical side of war. OB training gave Hugh, as he wrote his mother, access to the mainspring of the whole machine of war and showed him much more of the actual workings of war than the average soldier or officer ever gets. "In this there is one constant and recurring moral," said Hugh, "namely that military force is a poor solution to any problem, at best a triumph of negation." On 23 September, Hugh graduated from the German Order of Battle course and was promoted to Master Sergeant. On 14 November, Hugh and the other 18 members of OB Teams 1 through 6 sailed for England. By 23 December, Hugh had been transferred to the headquarters of the British Intelligence Office at Hyde Park Corners in London, where all OB personnel were placed under temporary command of British Intelligence, who put them through another OB course, which was sniffily referred to as the real thing, highly classified and much more up-to-date. Following this, Hugh was stationed at the British War Office, where he helped to compile the catalog of German general officers for the June 1944 Order of Battle book. In January, the OB teams, each composed of two master sergeants and a lieutenant, were given their assignments. Each team was to be attached to an army group 100 miles from the front, recalls Hugh. That was as high and safe as you could get, but there would be one exception. One team would be attached to the 101st Airborne and therefore be among the first to land in Normandy. Hugh's OB team got the assignment. OB Team 5 reached the headquarters of the 101st Airborne at Grenham Lodge near Avebury at Wiltshire County on 21 January 1944, an unbelievably dark and stormy night. Hugh was thus in a unique position, a grandstand seat, as he called it, to view the European theater of World War II. As part of an order of battle team, his job was to see the war in overview, to be, as he called it, the hotly detached observer, to know the strength, disposition, and location of all units of both armies. However, being attached to the 101st Airborne, Hugh saw combat up close and personal from inside a foxhole, face all blackened and clusters of grenades on, carrying his trusty carbine. Now war was anything but theoretical. After he himself was briefed on the division's role in the upcoming invasion, Hugh was placed in charge of, as he put it, wising everyone up on the strength, disposition, and honest intentions of the Germans. Hugh's discharge papers document that during the months of January through May of 1944, he gave extensive instruction to large classes, 40 to 150, of officers and men of the 101st Airborne Division on German strategy and tactics, German Army organization, insignia, weapons, etc. For the D-Day invasion, Hugh was originally scheduled to land in Normandy by glider. However, only weeks before the invasion, Hugh was required to yield his seat on the glider to Brigadier General Don F. Pratt and was told that he would be driving a jeep ashore. "I didn't argue about that," states Hugh flatly. "You don't argue with a general, and I was not exactly sick at heart being told that I would have to come by sea and land on the beach." It was a classic case, however, of out of the frying pan and into the fire, since the jeeps would be arriving and diving right into the teeth of the German artillery emplacements on the beach. Pratt's glider, however, had worse luck. It crashed and Pratt was killed. There's a scene about this in Saving Private Ryan, if you recall it, if anybody's interested. As dawn broke, the huge guns on the battleships accompanying the fleet began pounding the coast of France. Soon the German 88s were responding to the fury. Hugh stood on the deck of the ship watching the bombardment and talking with the army chaplain. Satirizing his own thirst for being first, he pointed out that he had more than enough of it on this experience. "Our ship headed the convoy as if that were not enough. Our party was to be first ashore when contact was made with the division. The ship was bombed repeatedly but never hit. I stood at the head of the rope ladder for half an hour and then went down to the landing craft without orders. Presently, the very spot where I stood was hit by an 88 and half a dozen tank men blown up. The chaplain with whom I had been talking was wounded." Ernest Hemingway, who was then a war reporter, described the LCTs sinisterly as small coffin-shaped still boats. Hugh does not say what he thought as he descended into it alone. Eventually, the rest of the men assigned to the LCT were ordered to board. While the storms had calmed somewhat, the sea was rough and cold and increasingly dangerous. Soldiers in full gear struggled to climb down the slippery, cold net in the pitch black of night, of early morning, rather. They tangled themselves in the fouled nets, clinging desperately as the craft rose on a wave almost halfway to the ship's rail, then dropping down in a trough almost out of sight. At low tide, Utah Beach was a 300 to 400-yard coastline approximately 20 miles west of Omaha Beach. A low concrete wall rose several yards inland, backed up by German fortifications. As the LCT approached the sandy beach, the German 88 shells tried hard to stop us, first landing in front and then behind, remembers Hugh. But he could also see geysers of sand going up all over the place on Utah Beach from the Allied bombardment. The ship the LCT had just pulled away from took a ferocious series of hits and sank. As the LCT neared the beach, a massive steel drawbridge door on the front of the craft swung down to allow the troops to dive into the surf. A command car, driven by a big red-headed Texan, as Hugh calls him, was the first vehicle out. It disappeared into the sea and was never seen again. Next came Hugh, his Jeep waterproofed and loaded with sandbags, the men clinging on to give it as much purchase as possible on the sandy bottom of the beach. All I had to do was press on the gas and it would go straight ahead, remembered Hugh, and everyone was yelling, "Go it, Nibs, keep going, keep going." Only Hugh's head and shoulders stuck out of the water as he wrestled the tough little Jeep through the surf onto the beach. In a strange episode of double consciousness, Hugh hit the beach with the Book of Mormon passages spinning in his head, like a Greek warrior going into battle chanting Homer. But rather than celebrating the glories of war, Hugh heard the heavy thud of fulfilled prophecy. 2 months before the invasion, he wrote his mother, "Of course there is little time to relax in airborne in a time like this, but when I can snatch a moment or two off, it's devoted to a single engrossing item. At this late date, I have discovered the Book of Mormon and live in a state of perpetual excitement. That marvelous production throws everything done in our age completely into the shadows." Making his way from the beach to headquarters was not easy. The Germans had the men pinned down for some time. Of course, it was better than Omaha Beach. And Hugh recalls taking refuge in a foxhole. "I was about to eat a chocolate bar, and I jumped into the foxhole, and it was full of, spattered with brains, a helmet full of brains and so forth. It was a bloody mess in there, and I immediately lost my appetite. And then after a few minutes, I got hungry and ate the chocolate bar just as unconcerned as anything. I never thought I could do anything like that. I never thought I could, but apparently you can shut off certain parts of the brain." The first few days of the invasion were dicey. "It was very bad," Hugh says. "We were not only hopelessly outnumbered, we were getting no supplies. We were in a desperate situation." When not bogged down in a foxhole, Hugh spent his time wading through documents, correspondence, paybooks, maps, and other papers confiscated from German POWs and war dead. He would sift through the mass of paper for any information that might help determine German troop positions, minefields, or gun emplacements. He also received G2 intelligence reports from other units, which would help the OB teams get the big picture of the German war operations. Additionally, he would receive unedited POW interrogation reports. Since he knew the German order of battle by heart, he could swiftly extract useful information, feeding the stream into the constantly updated Allied OB files. Being an OB team meant that Hugh had a grip on the constantly shifting elements of battle, while being assigned a headquarters company meant that he also saw firsthand the bloody work of war. In a letter to his mother, he praised the valor of the 101st Airborne. "No reports can exaggerate the merits of the boys of the 101st, Hugh wrote. "The exalted zeal that usually invests a few rare souls in the heat of action seems to hold whole battalions for days on end, so that if just one paratrooper was in place, we could say that position was ours. I'm all admiration for these chaps who you can count on in every situation. This emotion I share even with those horribly conceited German officers who, when pressed, will finally admit our moral superiority." At the same time, these men were not saints. Early in the invasion, one platoon of American soldiers held a French wedding party at gunpoint while the men took turns raping the bride. General Taylor, quote, was very much upset when he heard of the incident, Hugh says. He said, boys, don't you ever do things like that. But that's absolutely typical, Hugh says, and I know much worse things than that happened. On 11 June, Hugh wrote to his mother, reassuring her that he had survived the invasion. You know, nothing can keep me from telling all. Only the censor has first priority and last say. But here goes for running the gauntlet. I'm in utter health and my usual high spirits. His only complaint, a scholarly form of bravado, was that at present I'm neglecting both hieroglyphic and cuneiform. On 30 June, 24 days into the invasion, Hugh wrote, the late great Justice Holmes called war an organized bore. Even the fastest moving situation somehow lacks any sense of freshness or novelty. And the noisiest battles are the stupidest, I'm told. As order of battle man, I'm supposed to know what goes on and preserve an eerie secrecy in all things. Sees all, knows all, tells nothing. On 13 July, replacements took over the areas secured by the men of the 101st Airborne, the region from Utah Beach to Saint-Mère-Église to Verville, and after one of the bloodiest battles of the invasion, Carentan. Hugh accompanied the survivors back to England. From the relative comfort of his barracks at Grenham Lodge, Hugh wrote his mother, all serene again in my department. After some fuss, we are at last able to view the situation again with some measure of detachment. Viewing situations with detachment is my particular business, the only interesting job in the war. Only when the view becomes more important than the detachment, interest tends to give way to alarm, and as you know, I scare easily. Next, Hugh was involved in a period of frantic preparation for the next operation and frustrations of the ever-changing plans. Quote, the objective would be chosen, the whole operation rehearsed, everyone resigned to fate, and all set to take off, and then we would get word that Patton had already reached the place, or was so near it that we would not have to go in. This happened again and again and was very trying. Then on 17 September 1944, the largest airborne operation in history took place, Operation Market Garden, an Allied invasion of Holland. The mission of the 101st was to parachute in or land by glider into Holland in broad daylight and secure the road into the Rhine River and make it possible for the British to cross into Germany. This time, Hugh took a glider. The first flight went late on September 17, says Hugh, and the pilots came back with the worst possible news. Terrible weather, murderous flak, and waiting for us in the landing zone a division of German tanks. But it was too late to turn back. Regardless of whether we would have to make a try for it the next day, again I was number two man in number one glider on the right, the ones the Germans always try for. Of course I became very sick, as I always do in a glider. There was an old piece of armor plate lying on the floor, and out of curiosity I wondered how it would be to sit on. Just as I slipped it in my little chair with a characteristically witty remark, it absorbed three machine gun bullets while another went between my feet. This particular episode became proverbial in headquarters company. Because of these narrow escapes and several others like it, soldiers in his division began to say a little proverb about Hugh, everything happens to Nibley, but nothing ever happens to him. From Holland, Hugh wrote his mother that, quote, I am cheating like mad, still plugging away at Arabic and Russian when no one is looking. Operation Market Garden was just as chaotic as D-Day had been, but even larger German forces were waiting for the Allies than they had foreseen. The campaign was, quote, touch and go, with our people scattered all over the land and surrounded and outnumbered most of the time, recalled Hugh. Hugh's discharge papers indicate that he was involved in gathering information, quote, by personal interrogation of prisoners of war, examination of captured documents, and special contacts with civilians and underground personnel. By mid-October, a month into what Hugh called the brown horrors and melancholy shades of the Holland campaign, it was obvious to everyone that the operation had been a failure. It was bleeding the Allied forces of troops. They'd achieved nothing but a stalemate. On 23 October, Hugh waxed philosophical as he watched the war of attrition continue into its fifth week. The interesting thing about our age is that not many people are really fooled, wrote Hugh. We are going into perdition with our eyes open. The separation of the tares and the wheat is strictly a free will affair. Finally, on 27 November 1944, Hugh and the troops of the 101st Airborne left the front lines in Holland. They'd spent 72 days in battle, most of them in muddy foxholes. During that time, the 101st Airborne suffered 3,792 casualties. On 28 November, the troops were trucked into France for rest and recuperation from the ordeal of Holland and to prepare for redeployment. The camp, Mourmelon-le-Grand, located some 20 miles south of Reims, had been a battlefield for centuries. Julius Caesar had legions there in 54 BC. The French had occupied it during World War I, the Germans after June 1940, and now the new legions of the Americans had arrived. It was very gloomy, Hugh recalls. I was right back to World War I, right back to where we started. It was another reminder that the wisdom of men continues to run in a cycle of foolishness and deadly destruction. Hugh was now the only uninjured survivor of his OB team. So in early December, he set up an office with George Allen, an interrogator who he'd met at Camp Ritchie, who later ran an antiquarian bookstore that Hugh got a lot of BYU's library from. The classics scholar and Philadelphia bookstore owner began to plot the location of the Allied German troops, and soon Hugh and he had deduced that the Germans were planning to break through the lines at Bastogne. I predicted it right on the button, notes Hugh. To him, it was obvious exactly where the breakthrough would come, who would be there, how strong it was. However, headquarters ignored these reports. Hugh summed up the debacle sharply. The big boys at Army Group insist that the breakthrough took them totally by surprise. Although he usually shrugged off most of the manifestations of official stupidity, he characterized this face-saving maneuver as an unpardonable state of affairs. Hugh was called to Paris just as the 101st was heading for the Ardennes. The two-man OB team that replaced him was killed the next day. From Paris, he was sent on a safe but quite melodramatic counterintelligence mission right back to where he'd been, in the Ardennes. While the Allied successes at the Battle of the Bulge and everywhere else were cause for military optimism, Hugh saw no moral reason to rejoice. In early February, he wrote, "We can expect no security anymore. Too many people misbehaving." He was alarmed by the Germans, who he said, quote, "have changed much for the worse, and their intensive course in auto-infatuation. But he was also alarmed by the Americans. The end of the war became the high tide for opportunists, as he called it. One would like to ignore them, but they're going to wreck everything. Just wait and see. As the war came to a close, Hugh was stationed in Heidelberg, where he and other intelligence men were sorting and processing documents left by the retreating German army. He wrote bitterly to Paul Springer, "During the last few months, I've had some extremely interesting documents in my hands." For Heidelberg is the official depository of all German war documents. Invariably, these paper-loving boors waited until too late to destroy documents, and the result is that you had better not try to tell little old me who started the war. Even more disillusioning than the documents implicating German leaders and war crimes was the clear involvement of several U.S. corporations in profiteering schemes during the war. Hugh later wrote, "The tension, suspicion, and sheer despair that filled the air of Heidelberg were at times simply unbearable." Several days after the German concentration camp of Dachau was liberated on 29 April of 1945, Hugh visited the camp. To this day, this is the one war memory Hugh refuses to discuss. It was a blow that drove him deeper into disillusionment. Quote, "The major change in my constitution," wrote Hugh distractedly to a friend in August, "has been the development of a deep and chronic dislike for anything German. After 3 months in lovely Heidelberg, the only undamaged city in Germany, I am fed up. It is a wicked world, and one in which there is little to choose between one group and another. But one of the few things that is clear is that the Germans, by their own choice, are a world apart, whose monumental humbug is only equaled by their zeal for dehumanizing everything they touch." He was emotionally shattered by the revelations at the war's end, as he had not been during the war itself. "I was particularly miserable because I knew the fundamental excellence that lay beneath the rubble heaps of folly and ruin, and what a vast and admirable intelligence was being dedicated to wanton destruction. Why must the Germans behave that way?" Hugh bitterly concluded. "It is the Germans themselves who have not been true to their great tradition. You have no idea how sterile and immoral the Nazi mind was, or do you?" Nor could Hugh take comfort in the ideals of his own countrymen. As the American army settled into occupation mode, both morale and morals declined sharply. Quote, "The god of battles has become the god of brothels," Hugh wrote in Revulsion. Looting, drinking, and whoring were the chief activities of American soldier in post-war Germany. Hugh grew deeply depressed as he watched some of, quote, "those of whom I knew for the best of saints give up their good works in weary disgust and turn to the ways of the world in the worst possible sense. I don't know a single exception. The army is extracting a frightful toll for its noisy services." After the war ended in Europe, Hugh gloomily assumed that he would end up in the Far East, though I don't relish the prospect, he said. However, the war with Japan ended shortly thereafter when the United States dropped atomic bombs on Hiroshima on August 6th and 3 days later on Nagasaki. On 14 August, Japan surrendered. Despite his personal relief that the war had ended, Hugh darkly predicted that the new bomb, quote, "has already made the next war inevitable and perhaps final." He resignedly commented, "If we must act with the high-minded or the high-handed immortality of the gods, it's only right to have our bluff called and reins thrust into our hands. But of course, there can only be one end to the farce." On 27 October, Hugh sailed for the States, arriving on 9 November 1945, and he was later discharged at Fort MacArthur, where he'd begun his military service 3 years, 1 month, and 22 days earlier. He was given an honorable discharge. It was Hugh's his knowledge of ancient history, coupled with his careful reading and deep understanding of the scriptures, that shaped his view of world events in the 1940s. But it was his experiences in World War II that led him to believe that war was immoral, satanic, and shameful, as he called it. His years of combat taught him 6 things. First, he learned that men on both sides of the conflict were basically good. But, however, the second thing he learned was that men on both sides were capable of great evil. Immediately following the war, Hugh quoted a historian named Burckhardt in summing up the evils of war. He said, "Behold the soldier. When he is hungry, he steals. When he is full, he fornicates. That covers everything." Third, Hugh learned that in military, careers are built chiefly on the battlefield. As a result, ambitious men longed for the continuation of war. Just before the Battle of the Bulge, Hugh wrote to his friend Lucian Goldschmidt, another book dealer, "The whole world today is paying the price of a few careers. I have never objected to being the simple-minded implement of other men's greatness, but one can hardly submit to that without becoming the foil of their spite. For when the mighty fight, the mighty clash by proxy, we are the humble abrasive that polishes their armor." Hugh later used this as an illustration of the Book of Moses' Mahan principle of converting your life into my promotion, he called it. Fourth, Hugh discovered an even more frightening example of the Mahan principle, that of converting life into property, your life for my property. Fifth, Hugh gained a firm knowledge that the military is able to control few things, but also capable of supreme chaos and large-scale blunders. As he wrote from Heidelberg at the end of the war, "The army is no more incompetent than it ever was. Only during operations, its blunders are strict military secrets. Oy, could I write a book, me with my grandstand seat, always the hotly detached observer." Finally, the most important lesson I believe Hugh learned from the war was that it's wasteful and wrong. I remember General Bradley said, Hugh remembers, "War is waste." And that's what it is, you see, the utter wastefulness of the thing. But the wrongness of what we were doing was so strong that everybody would cry. People would cry. They would weep. It was so utterly, unspeakably sad. It was so sad you could hardly stand it that people would do such things to each other. After witnessing the horrors of war, Hugh was likely suffering from what we would now call post-traumatic stress syndrome. He spent many months recuperating in the wilderness of Zion's National Park and avoided discussing the war altogether. In his work on the Book of Mormon, Hugh discussed wars in the Book of Mormon, but only in very abstract terms. Hugh confessed that he was always repulsed and fatigued by the 170 pages of wars and alarm in the Book of Mormon, and that he always felt inclined to rush through the military parts of the Book of Mormon as painful reminders of an unpleasant past. But as Hugh watched the Vietnam War escalate in the 60s, he could no longer remain silent. He strongly warned church members that their mission was to engage in peace, not war. He first articulated this anti-war message in his 1967 book, Since Camorra. It was published when 380,000 U.S. troops were stationed in Vietnam, and U.S. casualties in the war had reached 6,664 dead, with 37,000 plus wounded. Since Camorra was, like his previous books, devoted to surveying evidence for the truth claims of the Book of Mormon, but in it, Hugh seized the opportunity to outline the Book of Mormon's approach to war. Hugh believed the Book of Mormon paints war in very authentic terms, which would be inconsistent with the type of romanticized fiction circulated in frontier America. But he saw the presence of wars in the book as much more than just evidence for the book's authenticity. The wars are there to warn us. Quote, the whole point of Alma's, or rather Mormon's, studies in the work of death, as he calls it, is that they are supposed to be revolting. They are meant to be painful. It is Mormon and Moroni, the tragic survivors of a nation destroyed in a senseless war, who are editing this book. They put into it whatever they think might be useful as a warning to us. It is not their purpose to tell an entertaining or reassuring tale. Hugh concludes that the Book of Mormon authors saw war as nasty, brutalizing, wasteful, dirty, degrading, fatiguing, foolish, immoral, and above all, unnecessary. Furthermore, he argued that the Book of Mormon shows war as the inevitable fruit of wickedness on both sides. Contrary to conventional thinking, Hugh argued that war is never a case of good guys versus bad guys, but it's always, as the Book of Mormon puts it, the wicked that are punished by the wicked. Whenever our Nephites and Lamanites fight, it's because they have both rebelled against God, Hugh wrote. One of the most audacious acts of Hugh's career, I believe, was to challenge the message of a film that was aired at BYU in 1971 entitled No Substitute for Victory, in which appeared such conservative Hollywood personalities as John Wayne and Martha Ray. But alongside them was then-Apostle Ezra Taft Benson in his role as former Secretary of Agriculture. The film argued that the United States could win the Vietnam conflict quickly if military rather than political leaders were put in charge, and inspired a very heated debate in the BYU Daily Universe. You'd be surprised by this debate, because it was not one-sided at that time. Students either felt the film was right-wing propaganda, or they felt that it was God's will being testified by the presence of the senior apostle in the film. Hugh weighed in on the debate in a letter to the editor, in which he argued that there was indeed a very good substitute for victory, and he cited the Doctrine and Covenants, which commands the saints to renounce war and proclaim peace. Renounce is a strong word, continued Hugh. We are not trying to win peace by war or merely call a truce, but to renounce war itself, to disclaim it as a policy while proclaiming, that means not just announcing, but preaching, peace without reservation. He warned, if we do not take this course, the whole earth will be cursed and all flesh consumed, thus leaving only two choices, either to renounce war or be destroyed. If anyone questioned Hugh Nibley's loyalty to the church for speaking out against the Vietnam War, particularly when he was taking a position different from one of the senior apostles, it was moot after the Ensign published his anti-war essay, If There Must Needs Be a Fence, in July of 1971. From Vietnam through the Cold War on to the 1991 Gulf War, Hugh has consistently argued that war, hot or cold, is a poor substitute for diplomacy. On several occasions in his life, Hugh has related an incident that happened in Normandy, where another man was ordered to shoot a German. On 11 June 1944, the 502nd Regiment took the bridge into Cairn Tan with a bloody bayonet charge. It's one of the most horrific incidents in Normandy. Soon thereafter, as the men of the 101st were mopping up, searching through the town for any remaining Germans, someone noticed that there was a suspicious-looking man looking out a window of a factory. Intelligence officer Major Paul Dunahay ordered a small patrol to go into the factory and capture the man. They soon came back with him in tow. Major Dunahay assumed that since the man was German, he must be a spy, so he ordered Sergeant David Bernay to take him out and shoot him. Bernay was, as Hugh remembers, a fiery little Jew who won a Silver Star with two clusters. He was no friend of the Nazis, Hugh says. As Bernay escorted to a ditch, step over the ditch, Bernay ordered in perfect German. Surprised, the German asked, do you speak German? David responded, yes. "Where are you from?" the German demanded. "I come from Maximiliansau," Rene replied. "Maximiliansau, that's a little place on the Rhine. There was a celluloid factory there," exclaimed the German. "Yes," Brene said. "Did you know Herr Brene?" asked the German. "He's my father," replied David Brene. The German said, "Well, this must be little David." Hugh pressed the punchline. It turned out the man he was about to shoot was his father's close friend. He had managed the factory where David's father had worked, and he was the one who had made it possible for the Jewish family to escape from Germany and get back to New York. The two men threw themselves at each other and embraced. Instead of shooting the German, Brene took him back to the camp, and the German became a valuable source of intelligence for the Allies. Incidents like this convinced Hugh that war diabolically forces us to create divisions, rupturing the essential unity that should bind us to each other as sons and daughters of God. Is there a point at which war is justified? A point at which the evil caused by war would be less than the evil that would remain? The Hugh Nibley of today doesn't seem to think so. When I asked Hugh recently if he would join the army if he had to do it over again, Hugh responded with a firm and definite no. However, as a young man, Hugh had criticized Chamberlain's policy of appeasement and voluntarily enlisted in the army. Certainly events and age have shaped Hugh's attitudes. He was not immune from the widespread cynicism about war as a solution that was part of the legacy of the Vietnam conflict. However, as he noted when he returned to visit Utah Beach in 1984 during filming of Faith of an Observer, "Every conflict must sooner or later be settled by discussion. So why not have the discussion now and avoid the senseless conflict," he asks. Thank you.
Okay, we have a microphone for those that would like to ask questions. If you can just raise your hand so that we can record your question on the tape, and then Boyd will be able to respond. Are there any questions?
I've just arrived from Jordan in the Middle East, and I think that everything you've quoted from Hugh Nibley is relevant to today's beating the war drums in the whole Arab world, and every statement he's made about war applies to today, and America is in the wrong direction, doing the wrong thing. And I'd just like to warn you all that it's going to come back on our heads.
Has Hugh made any statements on the war in the Middle East?
I have not really directly asked him about that. But I have to say, I was in the Middle East many years ago. It's been probably 5 or 6 years ago, and I was in Jordan. But it was after the Gulf War. And it was really interesting being there, where a lot of the people were sympathizing with Saddam Hussein and saw war as an aggressor. And yet at the same time, you know, I felt a great deal there were some people who really hated Americans, and they could tell we were Americans because I was with a tour group. But at the same time, you couldn't help but tell that these were people just like us. I felt it was very unfortunate that there was this division between us that was created by our governments, not by us.
Boy, I have one big question made up of lots of little questions. And maybe you touched on this earlier. I'm wondering if Hugh's experiences in war affected his belief in God, how he dealt with the horrors that he was seeing with the existence of God, and also if his experiences, he seems most critical of Germans, at least from what you read, but did that generalize out to all of humanity? Did he have a pessimistic view of humanity, and how has that changed over time? How does he feel about Germans now, for example?
You know, you've got several questions there that are really good. First off, I think Hugh's attitude did evolve. In terms of his relationship with God, he seems to have had a fairly constant faith in God, and that doesn't seem to have changed much in the war. And in fact, I think that he saw war as fulfilling prophecy in a lot of ways. He read the Book of Mormon and saw this as fulfilling the kind of prophecies he saw there. So I don't think it affected his sense of God. He had a very strong impression early in the war that he was going to survive it all. And so he carried that kind of with him. He tells another story that I left out of this presentation about a man who was assigned to the 101st with him, who had the opposite impression, who really felt strongly that he was going to die. And he says that this guy carried him around. They wandered the streets of London looking for fortune tellers who could predict, you know, what his outcome would be. And he never got a satisfying answer. And the guy did die. So I think Hugh always felt like there was some kind of divine providence behind the whole thing, even though it was humans that were screwing up. What was the other part of the question? So as far as faith of God, I think if anything, it strengthened his faith of God in God, because I think he felt a certain dependence on God that he may not have felt in other times of his life. Did he see war as inevitable? I think Hugh, even from the letters he wrote on his mission, you get this sense that he sees war as an inevitable result of humans not repenting. That's kind of the path that you go through if a society doesn't repent. And so, yes, I think in that sense he does. There was another point you made that it was really good. Germans, yes. I think his attitude about the Germans really did evolve. I mean, before the war, and I didn't talk about this in the presentation, you'll have to read a little bit about this in the book, but before the war, he was very much sympathetic towards the Germans. He was engaged to a German at Claremont, and in some of the letters, he almost sounds anti-Semitic at times, which is a very interesting irony, because Hugh's grandmother was Jewish. So, and there's a certain... it's a very interesting thing, because his mother once was very proud of the fact that he looked German. I mean, looked Jewish, with a little bit of a Jewish nose, and she'd emphasize the nose and kept evident. Reed tells the story about how she'd kind of push their nose up to help make it look more Jewish, because they were competing with other kids in Southern California who were very Jewish. At the same time, she was very ashamed of the Jews and evidently was very, very anti-Semitic. And so some of Hugh's early letters have a degree of anti-Semitism in them. At Claremont, he was surrounded by a large number of Jews who had come over to America escaping the Nazis. And the anti-Semitism in his letters really stops about Claremont. And I think Ritchie, he met a lot, he became very good friends with a lot of Jewish people and a lot of German Jews. And I think his attitudes, his anti-Semitism, you never read any more about of that in his letters. In terms of Germans, I think he was very sympathetic towards the Germans. Like I say, he was engaged to a German at Claremont. She turned out to have a stronger tie to Germany than he thought. I believe she was a spy. He was very much opposed to the United States entering the war. He seemed to take the Germans' side at first. I think he very much felt like they were given a bum deal with the Treaty of Versailles and so forth. And so he seemed to have really taken the German side. However, between the early 40s and it was 1942 when he joined the army. So around the end of the 40s, or the end of the 30s, he had a real change of heart. He joined the army. As you saw in those letters, would interrogate these officers, he seems more critical of the Germans then and right after the war, and certainly Dachau would have a huge impact on that. He's very anti-German. And yet, at the same time, Hugh studied German. He was very much in that tradition. He'd read all the philosophy and was very... He considered himself part of that intellectual tradition of the Germans. So I think with time, the cynicism he felt towards the Germans, he started to spread towards humanity in general. So I think you're right. I think his attitudes really evolved in that respect. Today, I don't think there's any kind of anti-German strain in his thought. and I think, like I said, I think it's really generalized to humanity. He's at once very cynical of the intentions of political leaders, be they Democrat or Republican, but also he's I think very optimistic about the future. There's a certain apocalypticism in his writings, if you haven't caught that, where he really seems to look forward to the end times. So I don't know if that answers the question or not.
How does Hugh handle it where God orders war, as he did in the Old Testament era, and also in the Doctrine and Covenants, where war is justified after negotiations?
There's an interesting piece that, I left out, that Hugh talks about this in specific terms. He says, in general, he compiled a list of places where God had sanctioned war and then a places where God had decried war. And he says, the general rule is God decries war. The exception is when he does sanction war. And so I think in general he feels like God does not like war, but feels like it's required when God demands it. But I don't think he felt like that World War II was inspired. Incidentally, J. Reuben Clark had similar positions on World War II and the Vietnam War, which is kind of interesting. I haven't determined this, but I have a feeling that may be why Hugh's anti-war article ended up in the Ensign in 1974, or 71, was maybe because of J. Reuben Clark's influence, although he would have been dead by then, I guess, wouldn't he? I don't know. It must continue on.
All right, we'd like to thank Boyd, and thank you all for coming and participating this morning. Thank you.